colony, with towns springing up across the region, there was little doubt among the Indians as to what the Pilgrims meant by the purchase and sale of land. From the start, Plymouth authorities insisted that all native land purchases must have prior court approval. By maintaining control over the buying and selling of Indian land, the colony hoped to ensure clear titles while protecting the natives from unscrupulous individuals who might use alcohol and even violence to part them from their property. In 1639, Massasoit and his son, Wamsutta, confirmed their original treaty with the colony and promised that they shall not give, sell, or convey any of his or their lands without the consent of this government. Initially, it appears, the transactions were quite informal, at least when it came to determining the price the English paid for the land. In November 1642, Massasoit agreed to sell a portion of what became the township of Rehoboth. The deed reports that the sachem chose out 10 fathom of beads and put them in a basket and affirmed that he was full satisfied for his lands, but he stood upon it that he would have a coat more. In 1650, he sold 196 square miles of what became modern Bridgewater for 7 coats, 9 hatchets, 8 hoes, 29 knives, 4 moose skins, and 10.5 yards of cotton. In 1652, he and Wamsutta sold the future site of Dartmouth for 30 yards of cloth, 8 moose skins, 15 axes, 15 hoes, 15 pairs of shoes, 1 iron pot, and 10 shillings worth of assorted goods. The following year, they sold lands in the vicinity of the Poconocuts' ancestral village of Soams for £35 sterling, currently worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $7,000. Today, the sums paid for Massasoit's lands seem criminally insignificant. However, given the high cost of clearing native land and the high value the Indians attached to English goods, the prices are almost justifiable. Certainly, the Pilgrims felt they were paying a fair price, and their descendants later insisted that they did not possess 1 foot of land in this colony but what was fairly obtained by honest purchase of the Indian proprietors. This may have been true as far as it went, but in at least one instance, lands bought from the Indians were subsequently resold at a 500% profit. In reality, the system cut the Indians out of the emerging New England real estate market. By monopolizing the purchase of Indian lands, Plymouth officials kept the prices they paid artificially low. Instead of selling to the highest bidder, Massasoit was forced to sell his land to the colonial government, and thus was unable to establish what we would call today a fair market price for the one native commodity, besides the ever-dwindling supply of furs, that the English valued. We have been taught to think of Massasoit as a benevolent and wise leader who maintained a half century of peace in New England. This is, of course, how the English saw it, but many of the Indians who lived in the region undoubtedly had a very different attitude toward a leader whose personal prosperity depended on the systematic dismantling of their homeland. As their land dwindled, the Poconocuts continued to be afflicted by disease. In 1634, smallpox and influenza ravaged both the Indians and the English in the region. William Brewster, whose family had managed to survive the first terrible winter unscathed, lost 2 daughters, Love and Patience, now married to Isaac Allerton and Thomas Prince, respectively. For the Native Americans, the smallpox epidemic was in many ways worse than the plague of 1616 to 1619. Their skin became so consumed with sores that their flesh adhered to the mats on which they slept. "When they turn them," Bradford wrote, "a whole side will flay off at once, as it were, and they will be all of a gore blood most fearful to behold. They die like rotten sheep." And yet, from Massasoit's perspective, his alliance with the English continued to serve him well. In 1632, The Poconoket's old enemies, the Narragansetts, attacked Soames. The Pilgrims had recently built a trading post near the village, and Massasoit took refuge in the English structure. Standish rallied to the sachem's defense, and the Poconokets were soon free to return to their village. The incident at the Soames trading post appears to have been a pivotal event for Massasoit. As Native Americans customarily did after undergoing a life-altering experience, he changed his name, calling himself Usamaquin, meaning Yellow Feather. Massasoit had promised on his sickbed always to remember the debt he owed the Pilgrims, particularly to Edward Winslow. And yet in true sachem fashion, Massasoit never ceased manipulating those around him. In 1634, the year that smallpox swept away so many Indians, he and Winslow were walking together from Soames to Plymouth. Unbeknownst to his companion, the sachem sent word ahead that Winslow was dead. Massasoit even instructed the messenger to show the residents of Plymouth how and where Winslow was killed. By this point, Edward and Susanna Winslow had had 5 children, including 7-year-old Josiah, the future governor of the colony. Needless to say, the Indian messenger's news created great grief in Plymouth. The following day, Massasoit appeared in Plymouth with Winslow by his side. When asked why he had played such a cruel trick on the inhabitants, the sachem replied that it was their manner to do so, that they might be more welcome when they came home. Winslow may once have saved his life, but that had not prevented the sachem from reminding the Pilgrims that death stalked them all. Over the course of the next decade, as King Charles and Archbishop Laud made life increasingly difficult for nonconformists in England, an estimated 21,000 Puritan immigrants flooded across New England, with larger, more economically successful colonies flourishing to the north, south, and west, Plymouth had become a backwater. But if they were now outnumbered, the Pilgrims could take consolation in the fact that the new arrivals shared their belief in a reformed Protestant church. For the last 10 years, the Pilgrims had conducted a virtual laboratory experiment in how an individual congregation removed from the intrusions of the Church of England might conduct itself. How much real influence the Pilgrims had on the development of what eventually became the Congregational Church is still subject to debate, but Bradford quite rightly took pride in how he and his little community of believers had laid the groundwork for things to come. "Thus, out of small beginnings," he wrote, "greater things have been produced by his hand that made all things of nothing, and gives being to all things that are, and, as one small candle may light 1,000, so the light here kindled hath shone unto many, yea, in some sort to our whole nation. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all the praise." The Puritans staunchly denied it, but their immigration to America had turned them, like the Pilgrims before them, into separatists. They might claim to be still working within the Church of England, but as a practical matter, with no bishops in New England, they were free to worship as they saw fit. With a clutch of Cambridge-educated divines scripting their every move, the Puritans of Massachusetts Bay developed a more rigorous set of requirements for church membership than had been used at Plymouth, where it had been assumed since the days of John Robinson that only God ultimately knew whether a person was or was not a saint. In the years since Robinson's death, the members of the congregation at Plymouth had resigned themselves to going their own, often ministerless way in the New World, and in the process they had become considerably less jealous about guarding their divine legacy. Now, with the arrival of the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay, it was up to others to become the spiritual arbiters of New England. Minimal from the beginning, the religious distinction between the Pilgrims and Puritans quickly became inconsequential, especially when in 1667, John Cotton, a Harvard-trained minister from Massachusetts Bay, became the pastor at Plymouth. Instead of serving as religious designations, the terms Puritan and Pilgrim came to signify 2 different groups of settlers, with the perpetually underfunded Pilgrims and their associates arriving in Plymouth between 1620 and 1630, and the more well-to-do and ambitious Puritans arriving in Massachusetts Bay and Connecticut after 1629. The influx of Puritan immigrants prompted the Pilgrims to rethink how the government of their settlement was organized, and once again, Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay followed a similar course. By the 1630s, each colony was ruled by its own general court, which included the governor and his assistants and, after 1638 in the case of Plymouth, deputies from the various towns. In addition to passing laws, levying taxes, and distributing land, the general court probated wills and heard criminal trials. As it so happened, Plymouth magistrates found themselves presiding over the colony's first murder trial just as the Puritans began to arrive at Boston Harbor. In the summer of 1630, the profane John Billington fell into an argument with his English neighbor, John Newcomen. A few days later, while hunting for deer, Billington happened upon Newcomen and shot him down in cold blood. Billington had believed, the historian William Hubbard later reported, that either for want of power to execute for capital offenses, or for want of people to increase the plantation, he should have his life spared. But with the appearance of the Puritans, the dynamics of the region had changed. By the fall, Bradford had already established a rapport with Massachusetts Bay Governor John Winthrop, and after consulting with him, Bradford determined that Billington ought to die and the land to be purged from blood. And he was executed in September 1630. That year, the infamous ne'er-do-well Thomas Morton made his way back to Marymount. Since the settlement was technically in his territory, Winthrop offered to kill two birds with one stone. The Puritans not only arrested Morton, they burned his house to the ground. Evidently, Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay had much in common. Convinced that they had God on their side, magistrates from both colonies showed no qualms about clamping down on dissent of any kind. In the years ahead, Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson were cast out of Massachusetts Bay for espousing unorthodox views, and in 1645, Bradford angrily opposed an attempt to institute religious tolerance in Plymouth. Soon after, the Quakers, who began arriving in New England in 1655, were persecuted with a vehemence that climaxed with the hanging of four men and women on Boston Common between 1659 and 1661. It was the Puritans who led the way in persecuting the Quakers, but the Pilgrims were more than willing to follow along. As a Quaker sympathizer acidly wrote, "The Plymouth saddle is on the bay horse." And in 1660, Isaac Robinson, son of the late pastor John Robinson, was disenfranchised for advocating a policy of moderation to the Quakers. In the beginning, the Puritan settlement to the north proved a financial windfall for the Pilgrims. What the new arrivals wanted, more than anything else, were cattle and hogs, which the Pilgrims now had in surplus. Over the course of the next decade, Plymouth experienced an economic boom fueled in large part by the rising price of livestock. Inevitably, however, the grandees of Massachusetts Bay began to cast what Bradford felt was a covetous eye on the profitable trading posts Plymouth had established in Maine and Connecticut. As Massachusetts moved into the region with outposts of its own, tensions rose between the Pilgrims and Puritans. But as became increasingly clear, the sheer size of what is now known as the Great Migration meant that Plymouth had no choice but to be shunted aside as it watched dozens of Puritan settlements spring up to the north and south. It was only a matter of time before Massachusetts Bay's economic ambitions brought the Puritans into conflict with the region's other occupants, the Native Americans. In the lower portion of the Connecticut River Valley lived the Pequots, a tribe whose economic might more than equaled that of the Puritans. When the captains of several English trading vessels were killed by Indians in the region, Massachusetts Bay seized upon the murders as a pretext for launching an attack on the Pequots. In many ways, the Pequot War of 1637 was the Puritans' Wessagusset, a terrifyingly brutal assault that redefined the balance of power in the region for decades to come. Much as Massasoit had done more than a decade before, a local sachem used the conflict between the Indians and English as an opportunity to advance his own tribe. Prior to the Pequot War, Uncas, sachem of the Mohegans, was a minor player in the region. But after pledging his loyalty to the Puritans, he and his people were on their way to overtaking the Pequots as the most powerful tribe in Connecticut. The Narragansetts, on the other hand, were less enthusiastic in their support of the English. The Pequots were their traditional enemies, but they were reluctant to join forces with Uncas and the Mohegans. Only after Roger Williams, the new founder of Providence, had personally interceded on Massachusetts Bay's behalf, did Narragansett sachem Miantonomo agree to assist the Puritans in a strike against the Pequots. Led by several veterans of the 30 Years' War in Europe, the Puritans fell upon a Pequot fortress on the Mystic River. After setting the Indians' wigwams ablaze, the soldiers proceeded to shoot and hack to pieces anyone who attempted to escape the inferno. By the end of the day, approximately 400 Pequot men, women, and children were dead. It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the same, Bradford wrote. And horrible was the stink and scent thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the praise thereof to God. Bradford saw the devastation as the work of the Lord. The Narragansetts, however, saw nothing divine in the slaughter. As Roger Williams observed, Native American warfare was more about the bravery and honor of the combatants than the body count, and usually only a handful of warriors were killed in battle. Prior to the attack on the Pequot Fort in Mystic, sachem Miantonomo had attempted to get assurances from Williams that no women and children would be killed. Unfortunately, Williams, who had been cast out of Massachusetts Bay just 2 years before, had been unable to extract any concessions from the Puritans. As the flames devoured every living thing in the fortified village, the Narragansetts angrily protested the slaughter, claiming it is too furious and slays too many men. With the Pequot War, New England was introduced to the horrors of European-style genocide. Before the massacre, the Pequots had urged the Narragansetts to join them against the Puritans, claiming that the English would soon overspread their country and force them off their own lands. In the years ahead, sachem Miantonomo came to realize that the Pequots had been right. By the late 1630s, when he saw that there were more Puritans in Massachusetts Bay than Native Americans in all of New England, he decided to eliminate the English threat before the Narragansett suffered the same fate as the Pequots. In 1642, he traveled to the Montauks on Long Island in hopes of persuading them to join the Narragansetts against the English. To accomplish this, he proposed a truly visionary strategy of pan-Indian cooperation. By laying aside their ancient differences, which the English had exploited so effectively during the Pequot War, the Indians might retake New England. Miantonomo's speech to the Montauks included an insightful account of the ecological endgame that had come to New England. "You know our fathers had plenty of deer and skins. Our plains were full of deer, as also our woods, and of turkeys, and our coves full of fish and fowl. But these English, having gotten our land, they with scythes cut down the grass, and with axes fell the trees. Their cows and horses eat the grass, and their hogs spoil our clam banks, and we shall all be starved." Miantonomo knew from experience that to pick a fight with the Puritans was to fight to the death. He proposed that they employ guerrilla tactics to kill men, women, and children, but no cows, since the Indians would need the English livestock for food until the deer had increased to pre-contact levels. In the end, Miantonomo was unable to follow his own advice. Instead of attacking the English, he attacked Uncas and the Mohegans. Like Massasoit before him, Uncas had parlayed his allegiance to the English into a sudden and, from the narrative,